We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is George Demacopoulos. I'm the Father John Meyendorf and Patterson Family Chair of Orthodox Christian Studies at Fordham University. I'm also the historian for the Order of St. Andrew. I'd like to welcome you to the first session of our Religious Freedom Conference, which is dedicated to providing a historical overview. As many of you, of course, know, Christianity is inherently a Middle Eastern religion. It was born in the Middle East. For the majority of the history of Christianity, the majority of Christians have lived in the Middle East. And, interestingly, for most of that time, Christians in the Middle East lived as minorities in one way or another. We have four panelists this morning that are going to take the long view, more than 1,000 years, of trying to help us understand how it could be that we now find ourselves in a situation where the very existence of Christianity in the Middle East is now in question. To help us with this, we have, from your left to right, Father Sidney Griffiths, who is professor of early Christian studies at Catholic University and perhaps the world's foremost expert in Syriac Christianity. Dr. James Skedros is Michael G. and Anastasia Cantonis Chair of Byzantine Studies at Hellenic College Holy Cross, where he serves as dean. Mark Movsesian is Frederick A. Whitney, Professor of Law at St. John's University Law School, where he also directs the Center for Religion and Law. And Samuel Tadros is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute's Center for Religious Freedom. The way this panel is going to work is each of our panelists is going to begin with a brief opening statement relative to their specific area of expertise. I will then ask the panelists a few questions, and time permitting, we will also field some questions from the audience. You have cards in front of you. If you would like to ask a question of the panel, write out your question, wave your hand. We have people who can pick them up and bring them to us. We are running a little quick on times, so I can't promise that we'll get to questions from the audience, but we hope to. So we'll begin with Father Sidney.
Well, good morning, everyone, Your Eminence, Reverend Fathers, brothers and sisters. It's a very important question we have before us today, as we all know. The troubling situation of the persecution of Christians, especially in the lands of Christianity's origins. But it's extremely important for us here in the West, and particularly in the United States, to know who our brothers and sisters, Christians of the Middle East, are. Who are their communities? What are their churches? It's for that reason that you have before you on the table a text that I've called Christian Communities in the East. I offer you this as a simple and quick way to gain some awareness of the great variety of the Christian communities who live in the Middle East. It's unfortunate that we in the West know so little about the Christian communities to the east of Constantinople. We all are well aware of how Christianity developed through the medium of the Greek language. We learn this already from the books of the New Testament, the letters of St. Paul. But it's important also for us to know that just as Christianity moved north and west from the Holy Land, it also moved east. And the vehicle of that carried Christianity to the east was the Aramaic language, that a dialect of which Jesus himself spoke. These are the churches of whom hardly anyone in the West knows much. So that's why I thought it was very important for us who want to raise awareness about not only the history of our brothers and sisters in Islamic lands in particular, but also having a sense of solidarity with them, knowing who they are and wanting to learn more about their heritage. For that reason, I thought in the brief time that I have, it might be important to talk about the gift to Christianity that many of these communities gave to the whole church at three moments in their history after the rise of Islam, because it's the time after their rise of Islam about which especially we Christians in the West know the least. I'd like to begin by mentioning a contribution of Christians from the Patriarchate of Jerusalem, and particularly the monasteries of the Judean desert, because it was there within 100 years after the Islamic conquest that Christian scholars began the laborious task of translating the Bible, the history, the patristic texts of our churches into Arabic. It was a mammoth undertaking. There's an enormous archive of Christian literature in Arabic, beginning from the middle of the 8th century up until just yesterday, about which hardly anyone in the West knows anything. And there are very few people who actually study it. But our brothers and sisters who have lived with Muslims from the very beginnings of Islam are the ones from whom we can learn most in our efforts to understand their churches and come to their aid today in their time of trouble. So the Patriarchate of Jerusalem, the Orthodox Church, contributed this enormous archive of Christian texts written in Arabic. Soon other churches in other places also joined that effort. But Jerusalem, in the first century of Islam, set the tone for how Christians in the new language would deal with their overlords. I move from Jerusalem in the 8th century to Baghdad in the 9th and 10th centuries. Very few people seem to know in the West that while Baghdad was founded as an Islamic city in the year 767, that it was also a city with a very strong Christian presence. In fact, the Patriarch of the Church of the East established his center, his seat in the city of Baghdad very early in Abbasid times, around the year 728. And all the churches in that particular milieu of Baghdad in the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, whether their ecclesiastical languages were originally Greek or Syriac or Armenian, contributed mightily to the development of what many people call classical Islamic culture. But it wasn't so much Islamic. Very few people know the mighty role that Christians played in creating this new and wonderful civilization. Perhaps the crown jewel of their contribution was the philosophical movement whereby the texts of Greek philosophy, logic, medicine, mathematics were translated from Greek to Syriac, to Arabic, and it was in the Arabic language that in the West, in the 12th century, they began to be translated into Latin and thereby became part of the renaissance of faith and philosophy in 13th century West, an accomplishment of the Christians associated with the patriarchs who lived in Baghdad. A very important thing is that this was a missionary church, and particularly those churches whose language were Syriac carried Christianity during Islamic times eastward. all the way across Central Asia and into Western China. We're talking about the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries. This was a mighty accomplishment of missionary work at a time of persecution, at least intermittently. Finally, another city, Cairo, in the 13th century. Coptic Orthodox Christians, scholars who wrote in Arabic, created a number of important texts, summaries of the Christian faith in the Arabic language, expressed in a way to speak to the challenge posed by the critique of Muslims, which to this very day are important texts in the conversation, religious conversation, between Christians and Muslims. It's important to look into these sorts of texts, how to express Christian truth in the language of Islam, that can help us in our efforts in our time to be engaged in the sort of dialogue that the patriarch called for in the letter we heard this morning. So I have only 5 minutes. I've probably gone beyond them. I'm sorry for that. But I hope perhaps everyone will just remember three moments: Jerusalem, Baghdad, Cairo. Gifts to the whole church from our brother and sister churches living in the world of the Muslims. Thank you.
Thank you, Father Sidney. Dr. Skedros.
Good morning, everyone. My remarks, brief remarks, will focus from the Byzantine historical perspective on Islam and the development of Islam within the historical period of Byzantium from the 4th through the 15th centuries, and I'll read them very briefly. Centered at Constantinople, the Byzantines were for centuries the greatest medieval imperial power in the Eastern Mediterranean. Prior to the advent of Islam, they controlled nearly all of the Middle East as Christianity flourished in its Greek, Syriac, and Coptic expressions. By the year 600 AD, the empire was thoroughly Christian. The loss of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt to Muslim Arabs following the death of the Prophet Muhammad essentially cut off Nestorian and Oriental Orthodox Christians from Byzantine rule, along with a smaller group of Chalcedonian Christians living in Palestine, Antioch, and Alexandria. Initially, the Byzantines viewed the expansion of Islam and the loss of Byzantine Syria, Palestine, and Egypt as only temporary. The Byzantines were less interested in the religious impetus of the Arab Islamic expansion into Byzantine territory than in how they were going to regain this lost land. From the Byzantine point of view, Muslim Arabs were another hostile enemy outside the borders of the East Roman Empire, which needed to be dealt with both militarily and diplomatically. From the second half of the 9th century to about the mid-11th century, Byzantine society faced few direct military threats from Muslim expansion. In fact, the Byzantines were successful in regaining Syria and Crete. During this period, cultural and political exchanges between Constantinople and the two Islamic centers of power in the east, that is Baghdad and Cairo, expanded. A celebrated example is the political embassy to Baghdad of the future Patriarch of Constantinople, Photios. Some 50 years earlier, the Caliph Mamun had unsuccessfully tried to entice the renowned Constantinopolitan scholar Leo the mathematician to relocate to Baghdad to offer instruction in the sciences and philosophy. Yet, persecution of Byzantine Christians did occur, most famously that of the 42 martyrs of Amorion, who were put to death on the banks of the Euphrates in the year 845 AD. Whether or not lasting peace between the two worlds of Byzantium and Islam was possible, there certainly were periods of truce. Peace treaties were negotiated on several occasions during the 11th century with the Fatimids of Egypt. In one such treaty, the Byzantines were able to secure permission to rebuild the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that had been destroyed by the Fatimid Caliph El-Hakim in the year 1009. And during the 11th century, treaties between the Byzantines and the Fatimids guaranteed protection of a mosque in Constantinople. It was during this period of Byzantine expansion and political stability that the Byzantines attempted to better understand the religious beliefs of their political enemies to the east. The first translation of the Quran into Greek appears at this time, as does a service of conversion from Islam to Christianity. Byzantium's relation with Islam took a decisive turn in the second half of the 11th century with the arrival of the Seljuk Turks into Asia Minor and the Byzantine military defeat at Manzikert in 1071. As Turkish presence in Asia Minor intensified, conversions from Christianity to Islam appear more frequently in Byzantine sources, reflecting a slow and gradual assimilation of Christians to Muslim Turkish society. Turkish rule over the traditional lands of Byzantium followed the legal precepts of Islamic law in dealing with Christian populations. Christians who did not convert to Islam or were not sold into slavery were required to pay the jizya tax or were taxed as part of their dhimmi status, a legal status within Islamic law that allowed Christians to maintain and practice their Christian faith within limits. Beginning in the second half of the 14th century, the Ottomans instituted the practice known as the devşirme, a levy of Christian boys gathered from among the dhimmi who were trained to serve in the elite Ottoman guard, the Janissaries. The final destruction of the Byzantine Empire in 1453 did not eliminate Byzantine Christian presence in the Mediterranean. In Asia Minor, several centers of Christianity flourished up to the exchange of the Muslim and Christian populations of Greece and Turkey in 1923. The Christians of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt continued their long odyssey with Islam that began during the first half of the 7th century. If we were to frame Muslim-Christian relations during the Byzantine period by the title of this conference, that is, the persecution of Christians, I would suggest that we keep in mind four overarching observations. First, though there were many examples of forced conversion to Islam and Christian martyrdom at the hands of Muslims, the historical record is not overwhelmed by this fact. In fact, there are equal number of examples of coexistence between the two faiths, if not more. Second, conversion to Islam was more the result of socioeconomic and political pressures Christians faced as living as second-class citizens. Third, Islamic law placed significant barriers upon Christian communities, which limited, if not at times eliminated, their potential for growth both numerically and materially. And fourth, Muslim-Christian relations took place within a larger context of medieval states fighting for their very survival against military and economic foes. In the Eastern Mediterranean world of the medieval period, Byzantine and Muslim relations were dependent upon political and socioeconomic considerations coupled with deep religious biases. Unfortunately, geopolitical and economic realities overshadowed issues of religious freedom. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Movsesyan.
Thank you. Well, first I'd like to thank George and the Archons for inviting me here and also for the very important work that you're doing here in Washington this week. In my brief remarks, I'd like to mention a historical episode, the 19th century Ottoman movement known as the Tanzimat, and its effect on Armenians and other Christians in the Ottoman Empire. The Tanzimat, the word in Turkish means reorganization, was a wide-ranging reform movement from the 1830s to the 1870s. The reforms were supported and perhaps even instigated by the West, which sought, among other things, to achieve legal equality and relieve the situation of Christians in the Ottoman Empire. Although the movement was well-meant and had some success, in the end, the Tanzimat exposed the Christians to a violent backlash and actually worsened their situation. I believe this episode may offer some lessons for today. For centuries before the 1800s, as Dr. Skedros says, the Ottoman Empire generally conformed to the classical model of Islamic government, in which the state had a religious foundation and was organized along confessional lines. In classical Islamic law, Christians were tolerated as dhimmis, the subject of a notional treaty called the dhimma, which granted Christians some state protection and some communal autonomy in exchange for Christians' payment of a poll tax called the jizya, which Dr. Skedros mentioned, and their acceptance of social and legal inferiority. Now, the dhimma was not always strictly enforced. Christians could live peaceably with their neighbors for long periods, and individual Christians could rise in society. But a sense of social and legal inferiority always existed under the dhimma, even in the best of times, and Christians could suffer brutal repression if they breached the treaty, for example, by affecting an air of equality. Conspicuous displays of wealth could be perceived as an insult and lead to violence as well. Persecution could also follow if Christians were perceived as having violated the dhimma by cooperating with foreigners, especially during periods of strict and militant Islam. The 19th century Tanzimat reform movement radically altered this arrangement by removing the dhimmi restrictions and, in theory, granting legal and social equality to Christians. Now, historians debate whether this movement was genuinely internal to the Ottoman Empire or forced on the empire by outsiders. Certainly, European governments pressured the empire to make the reforms, in part from humanitarian concern and in part from more crass political motives. The Tanzimat granted Christians equality in the courts, in the military, and the civil service, and with respect to taxation. It outlawed all discrimination against Christians, even name-calling. Conversion from Islam to Christianity, once a crime punishable by death, was made, as a formal matter, legal. Despite great hopes, the Tanzimat failed Christians. In the end, the reforms caused a violent Islamic backlash against them within the empire. This is because the equality granted on paper subverted profound social norms. Historically, as I've said, attempts by Christians to rise above their station and cooperate with foreigners could occasion violent retribution. The Tanzimat fit that familiar pattern. The violation of centuries-old social understandings, combined with the fact that Christians seemed to have the support of Europeans, deeply unsettled conservative Muslim opinion, and led to the so-called Hamidian massacres of the 1890s, in which hundreds of thousands of Armenian and Syriac Orthodox Christians lost their lives. The European powers that had raised Christian hopes, in fact, did little to help them. Now, all this was a long time ago, and much has changed. Dhimmi rules no longer exist in most Mideast countries, and throughout the region, equality is enshrined in basic law. One could understand the episode I've described as simply a sad event from a different time, of interest only to historians. But I think lessons for today do exist. Notwithstanding formal legal equality, many legal and social restrictions on Mideast Christians continue. Conversion to Christianity is often still a crime, for example, and even if not a crime, conversion can easily lead to private violence. In the region's media, one hears Islamist complaints that echo the charges against Christians at the time of the Tanzimat in the 19th century. Christians have become too powerful and arrogant. Christians are treacherous. Christians are aliens who cooperate with our enemies. On this last point, many in the Mideast apparently continue to see Christians as foreign Western elements, even though Christianity is native to the region, as Dr. Griffith says, and Christians have been a part of Mideast society for 2,000 years. Now, I don't suggest that religion was the only factor in the 19th century persecution of Christians, or that it's the only factor in the persecution of Christians now. Undoubtedly, political and economic factors had and have a role. Nor do I mean to essentialize Islam or Christianity, both of which have multiple expressions. I maintain only that religious norms about Christian inferiority were an important factor in the backlash against Christians at the time of the Tanzimat, and that such norms continue and contribute to the mistreatment of Christians even today. Now, the lesson for today. In my opinion, given these social norms, the West must choose very carefully its strategy for helping Mideast Christians. The West shouldn't make promises that it can't or won't keep, and it shouldn't raise hopes that it doesn't intend really to fulfill. Whatever it does, in my opinion, above all, the West should be careful not to create conditions that lead to a backlash against Christians in the region. The West acted this way in the 19th century, and the result was a catastrophe for Mideast Christians. Now, of course, it's very difficult to know how to balance a concern for the genuine and authentic rights of Christians with other prudential factors. But whatever we do, I think we have to be careful to avoid steps that inadvertently make the lives of Mideast Christians even more difficult than they already are. I look forward to hearing from subsequent panels on how best we can help Mideast Christians without exposing them to the potential for greater harm. Thank you.
Sam Todros.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me and for organizing this conference. George has asked me to talk about the contemporary age, what's going on in the Middle East today. I want to pick on something that Mark has said, and that's the rules of similitude and how they have shaped perceptions of Christians. While the legal frameworks that Christians lived under for centuries, not being allowed to ride horses, wearing special colored clothes, not being allowed to build churches, such paying the jizya tax, all these restrictions, legal forms, were removed in the contemporary age, the social mindset, as Mark said, has not changed. Continuously, we see an incidence of persecution of Christians, those attacking them, viewing the Christians as that they forgot their rightful place, that they forgot that this is Islamic land, that Islam should be supreme in this land, and that as Christians, they are supposed to feel inferior. They are tolerated, but they're never equal. This might take the form of some legal restrictions still remaining. In the case of Egypt, a Christian's testimony in a court of law involving a personal matter involving Muslims is not accepted. A Sharia is applied in inheritance laws on the Christians, regardless of whether they like it or not. But it also takes the form of societal rejection, of people refusing to have a church in their land. They don't mind Christians praying in their village. Sure, you want to pray to whoever you want to pray to, that's fine. But that building should have no tower, should have no dome, should have no bell, should have no cross on top of it. There should be no public manifestation of Christianity. So the first issue here is this continuous lack of acceptance of real equality for the Christians of the Middle East. The second point I would make, perhaps the central crisis of the region, is that of the lack of acceptance of pluralism, of diversity of identity. In the Middle East, identity has been treated like a hat. You can only be one thing. You can only be an Egyptian. You can be a Copt and an Egyptian. Your loyalty is questioned then. The attempt at forced homogenization, the attempt to deny the cultures, languages of the Syriacs, of the Assyrians, of the Copts, all of these continuous attempts point to that central crisis of a lack of acceptance of diversity in the region, a diversity that has survived for centuries. Thirdly, the responsibility for the plight of Christians is often pointed at Islamist groups, those who raise the weapons and kill them. They are certainly the ones that have killed the most numbers. But the plight of Middle East Christians is not just the story of organized Islamist groups, whether those who incite or those that actually kill. It is also the story of government persecution and discrimination. In a country like Egypt, there isn't a single Coptic governor among the 27 governors of the country. There's a 1% of Copts allowed in the military and the police force. There isn't a single Coptic president of a university or a dean of a school. Not a single Copt among those millions of them is allowed into Egypt's intelligence service or into its the equivalent of its FBI. There's a less than 2% cap in the foreign service and 1.79 in the judiciary. These numbers point to the restrictions. And not just the living Copts. The Dead Copts as well. The history, this important contribution of Christianity to Egypt, to the other countries, is often wiped out from history. History is a line that starts with the pharaohs, Alexander the Great comes, and the Romans, and then there's this 300-year gap where nothing basically happened that we should ever learn about. The lack of government protection for Christians attacked, the resorting to reconciliation sessions that involve a complete lack of rule of law, resulting in a culture of not only impunity for those attacking them, not a single one has ever been punished for these mob attacks against Christians, but a culture of encouragement. You get to attack them, you burn a couple of houses, loot a couple of businesses, and in the reconciliation sessions, not only do you get away with it, but you also get your demand. If you demanded that the church not be built, well, that's what the session is going to allow for it. The fourth point I'd make, and I don't know if I've already exceeded the time, is about the Christian reaction. Many people, the lack of a violent reaction by Christians in Egypt, elsewhere in the region, to the persecution that they suffer from has puzzled many people. They've often painted them as helpless victims, sheep being taken to the slaughter. There is no doubt that the faith that these people have, their deep commitment to carrying their Savior's cross with him on that road, explains that reaction. But they are not helpless victims. They are also, with every step of their lives, showing defiance against this. If they are being denied equality in jobs because of their names, they proudly name their sons and daughters after their ancient saints. If they are persecuted, if they show their Christianity, nearly every Copt in Egypt would have a cross tattooed on his wrist here. In the last massacre affecting the Christians of Egypt, on 26th of May, gunmen of the Islamic State chose to stand on the road leading to a monastery, St. Samuel the Confessor, in Minya in Egypt. They stopped buses of Coptic pilgrims and asked them to declare the Islamic Shahada, to declare that there is no God but God and that Muhammad is his prophet. Refusing, these people were murdered. At night, as Copts welcomed the bodies of those martyred in the morning, those that had refused to say there is no God but God and Muhammad is his prophet, a chant emerged into the church as the bodies was entering. It wasn't a hymn, it wasn't a church slogan. They chanted in Arabic, La ilaha illallah, al-masihu huwa Allah. There is no God but God, Jesus is God. This is defiant. This is not the act of sheep. These are men that have agency, that pride themselves in their faith, and that continue despite these tremendous challenges. Thank you very much.
So let me start. We've tried to cover a long period of history here. We're here in D.C., as we said at the press conference yesterday, because this is, you know, if you want to sort of shape the geopolitical landscape, you start here in D.C., right? What might you say to the critic who observes and says, look, every time a Western superpower shows up in the Middle East, local Christians feel the backlash. It's the local Christians that suffer, if perhaps, like you said, Mark, because the Western superpower shows up, does a few things, disappears, and it's the local Christians who really suffer, whether we're talking about the Crusades, whether we're talking about the 19th century, whether we're talking about the Gulf War. From the long historical view, right, what role does a Western superpower, do you believe, have in trying to erect a peaceful coexistence in the Middle East? And whoever wants to go first, jump in.
Well, I confess I don't know. I don't know what the best, and I'm looking forward to this conference to find out what people think the best approach would be. Certainly, I guess I'd say two things. One is I do think that the sad history that I related suggests that the West needs to be very careful and not to expose Christians to greater danger, either by raising hopes that really will not be fulfilled or by encouraging a backlash and then not doing anything to protect the Christians. I think that's very important. As to what positive steps, look, there certainly are positive steps. There are ways to channel aid to Christians without necessarily making them overt targets. There are ways to try to nudge the situation. But actually, I'd like to hear what Sam has to say, because he's the person who's speaking about the present.
Sure. I think there are a lot of small things that can be done. I don't think a magic word or a magic action the president of the United States is going to call the president of Egypt on the phone and tell him, do something for the Christians, and things will magically improve for them. But there are a lot of small steps that can be done that can really make a change for people's lives. The vice president is taking an important trip to the Middle East this month to talk about the situation of Christians. It would be really helpful, for example, if, and I'll speak more about the Egyptian case that I focus on, if he would mention specific names of villages where the police forces have closed churches. That would really make a difference. The idea that the vice president knows the names of these villages would definitely leave an impact on the Egyptian president. It would be really helpful if he mentioned, we follow the attacks on Christians. We know that Egypt is doing its best. It would really be good if you apply the rule of law equally to everyone. We don't want a special status for Christians, but if Christians get attacked, why don't the people that attack them ever end up being tried? Why don't they ever get jail time for these mob attacks against them? The United States trains and funds a big portion of the budget of the Egyptian military. There is no reason why it shouldn't help the Egyptian regime forces in training and funding a special unit devoted to the idea of preventing mob attacks against the Christians in the country. There is no reason that the legal restrictions that are there are not raised, that restrictions on building churches are not an issue on the table. So I don't expect that Egypt's going to become a liberal democracy tomorrow where religious freedom is accepted. But there are definitely a lot of things that can be done through public condemnation and also through private conversation with the Egyptians, with the Egyptian authority.
I'll just say this isn't an answer to the question other than just a historical observation. It is interesting that the First Crusade was, in some sense, not initiated but invited by Alexios I, the Emperor of Constantinople, to come to Constantinople and to assist with the expansion of the Seljuk Turks from the east westward. But that was really not a religious, from Alexios's point of view, it wasn't really a religious attempt. It was really an attempt at regaining political control and land. And I just wonder at times when Western powers involve themselves in the regaining of land, whether that's, or to set up political entities like the Crusaders did, whether that has negative impacts as opposed to, as others have said here, more humanitarian, on the ground kind of responses.
Would you like to add to this, Father Sidney?
Well, I think that when the question arises, what can we do? The only minds that we can change immediately probably are our own. And one of the problems is that we Christians in the West know so very little about our brother and sister Christians who live among Muslims, both historically and in the present day. Our Western churches, for example, have sent missionaries into this area for a long time now. My church in the Middle Ages, various other American and Western churches in the late 19th century, early 20th century. The missionaries went. Their job was to convert Muslims to Christianity, but guess what? They didn't convert any Muslims. They converted other Christians to whatever their particular brand of Christianity might have been. And this, of course, contributed to the continued division of Christians and of the Christian community, and perhaps even played a role in the situation in which we find ourselves now. So in addition to lobbying our government, to supporting Christians in the Middle East, if we take a lesson from history, it's that we should learn more. I know there were many reasons why Christians in the West didn't know much about their brothers and sisters in the East. I mean, once after Muslims had gained political control of the whole area, there was very little communication with the Christian communities under Islamic rule. Not only that, as the Christians in the Islamic world learned the Arabic language, became major contributors to the development of culture within the world of Islam, maybe they came to seem a little bit foreign to their Western brothers and sisters. This can be remedied. We can learn about them. We can reach out to them. We can be brothers and sisters to them. Well, I'm wandering into the homiletics.
you're entitled. So, especially the two of you who spoke of the medieval period, you spoke of some periods of coexistence. We won't necessarily call it peaceful coexistence, but coexistence in a way that at least what we see on the news and we read about doesn't really seem to exist anymore. And so what I'd like to ask all of you, are there resources in the past of coexistence that can be reapplied today? Or have the conditions for a variety of political reasons changed so much that the example of coexistence in the Middle Ages really just isn't structurally functional today?
Sure. I think the survival and, in some cases throughout history, the flourishing of Christian communities under the rule of Islam was not just a factor of toleration by certain rulers, but was also, in a sense, a result of geography. It's not a surprise that the places where Christianity survived most were the mountains of Lebanon, where they found refuge there, were the south of Egypt, away from the center of authority. Of course, that geography is no longer there with us today. The mountains of Sinjar did not protect the Yazidis from the Islamic State. Right. It's the American airplane that did that. So there are different conditions today that changed things that really were an ally to minorities like geography. But there are other factors resulting from this forced homogenization, not just an attempt to turn the Christians into the model people that they want, but also of Islam itself. We just had in Egypt an attack on Sufis, a tradition that has flourished, been accepted as part integral to Sunni Islam throughout the centuries. And today they themselves, in their own mosque, they're targeted by the Islamic State affiliate in the Sinai. So that kind of forced homogenization of Islam itself has closed the rooms of toleration. Any Muslim reformer, those genuine voices that are pushing for toleration, are often accused of blasphemy, where blasphemy laws from Pakistan to Egypt are used to silence the debate. It's not a fair debate because only one side in that intra-Islamic debate carries the weapons. Only one side can accuse the other of blasphemy and thus result in him being dead. So even your allies within the Muslim community are often silenced and not capable of standing and supporting you.
I would say also, in addition to the geographical observation, it might be the demographic observation, that in the medieval period, just by sheer numbers, and by economic importance and even political importance as well, Christians were needed to be dealt with in perhaps a more equal way. So toleration existed in part because there was a benefit for toleration. But as one moves into, as His Eminence mentioned, one moves into the late 19th and 20th centuries, where the demographic presentation, representation of Christianity diminishes rapidly in the 20th century. I think as Christian communities become smaller, it becomes harder and harder for them to, or for Islamic societies to make a case for why should we have coexistence with such a small group. Whereas in the past, especially in Asia Minor, during the Turkocratia, the Greek community, the Orthodox community, and the Oriental communities were still large, viable communities. Egypt is an exception, I think, in the Middle East today because of their demographic numbers.
Yeah, and I'll just add out there, I'm not sure everybody realizes this, but there are probably more Christians in Egypt than in the rest of North Africa, the Middle East, Asia Minor combined, right? I mean, Egypt is kind of the last place where you really do have a large presence of Christians. We're going to actually end a few minutes early because we have a guest who has appeared. So before we invite him up, let me ask you to thank our first panel. And Mike Manitis is going to introduce our guest.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you, panelists. Microphone on. We have a special guest today who's not on the program, but is a leader in the United States Congress on ending the persecution of Christians. And the person who brought him here today, I'm introducing very shortly, but you'll hear from the introducer in great detail this afternoon. Many of us know him as Gus. Others know him as the leader in the United States Congress on Orthodox and Hellenic issues and with the administration. But what many of you probably don't know is Gus is also the co-vice chair of the Congressional Religious Freedom Caucus. So this is an important issue to him. He's brought a special guest with him today. So Gus, if you could please come up and introduce our special guest. Gus.
So very much. Ladies and gentlemen, what an honor to be here amongst all of you wonderful people. Your Eminence, Dimitrios, and also Angelos, Your Eminence Angelos, and also Dionysios, all members of the clergy. I hope I didn't leave anyone out, but it really is an honor to introduce one of my best friends in Congress and one of the best people in Congress. A wonderful person, and he actually has made protecting religious minorities throughout the world his priority in the United States Congress. There are about three or four members of Congress, Chris Smith from New Jersey, Trent Franks from Arizona, and this man right here, Jeff Thornberry, who continue to fight for our brothers and sisters in the Middle East and all over the world. He has his wife is Celeste. She happens to be here in Washington, his mother-in-law as well, and they're eating breakfast. But Jeff came over to speak to us, and he's a wonderful person. He has five daughters. I would tell Jeff it's a good thing we don't have Prika in the United States. You'd be in trouble. I do want to say this. Jess also took a leadership role. He literally sponsored the bill resulting in the genocide resolution, and that was a great accomplishment. Resolution 75, expressing the sense of Congress that the atrocities perpetrated by ISIL, also known as ISIS, against religious and ethnic minorities in Iraq and Syria include war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And they show a broad bipartisan support, the House passed the measure 393-0. The important designation of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide allows Congress and other U.S. government entities to pursue and enact remedies to provide expedited refugee assistance, to trigger financial sanctions on individuals or groups affiliated with ISIL, also known as ISIS, and to develop other measures to ensure justice for victims of religious persecution and punish perpetrators of genocide. That was all Jeff, ladies and gentlemen. And I tell him, if you don't accomplish anything else in the United States Congress, and he's on the Appropriations Committee, a very powerful member, it's definitely worth it, Jeff. And God bless you, Jeff, and I welcome Congressman Jeff Fortenberry from the great state of Nebraska.
Well, first of all, let me thank my extraordinary friend, good friend, Gus Bill Rockus, for his most generous introduction. He mentioned that I have five daughters, and since we have a number of the clergy here, I think this is okay to say. A Catholic nun one time stopped me upon seeing my family, and she said, "Blessed are you among women." That's okay, Your Excellency. Is that okay? Bishop, so nice to see you again, and Your Eminences, thank you for the kind welcome here. We're really grateful. And I'm sorry I don't, we're integrating into your conference here at the last moment, so I'm sorry I haven't had the fullness of experience to hear what you've been deliberating, but the few moments that I did, let me just from the bottom of my heart thank you all for your expertise, for your commitment of coming to Washington, for your attendance to the great faith tradition that clearly all of you possess, and frankly for your friendship with my good friend, Congressman Gus Bill Rockus, who is an extraordinary, steadfast, solid leader in the United States Congress, not only representing a particular background, which is both your culture and tradition, but a thoughtful application of what is right and good in public policy. There he is, and I hope that you all recognize what I recognize in his extraordinary day-to-day work. I happened to be in the room when Pope Francis was given a small crucifix. And this crucifix had made an interesting journey into Francis's hands. It had belonged to a young Syrian Christian, and he had been captured by the jihadist. And he was told, convert or die. And so he had to make a choice, and he chose. He chose Christ, and he was beheaded. His mother was somehow able to recover his body, and along with it this cross, and through the work of some extraordinary people whom I know in Austria, she was able to flee to Europe. And that's the long story by way in which this cross ended up into the hands of the Holy Father. That story is multiplied by in the thousands, as you all painfully know. We know certain stories of those who have given the ultimate witness, martyrdom, for the faith. But there are untold stories of thousands or others, of others who quietly gave their all because they believed in something sacred. They not only held to a tradition, they held to truth. See, this sacred space of conscience that gives rise to the expression of religious tradition, which we in many ways take for granted in our own country, cannot be taken for granted elsewhere. In the Middle East, you have had, even though Christians and other minorities are smaller in number, you have had a tapestry of religious diversity. And the sadness here is not only the loss of life and the destruction of community, but it's the potential loss of this ancient tapestry of diversity, which has so benefited the Middle East as a whole, creating the conditions for stability and pluralism. If you lose this, it's not only an injustice to the ancient faith traditions who have as much a right to be in their ancient lands as anyone else, but it is a further destabilizing factor in the Middle East. For all of these reasons, primarily driven by the concept, the essentials of justice, Gus and a number of members of Congress helped step forward to lead what we called the genocide resolution. I happen to represent the largest, another religious minority, the largest number of Yazidis, who are an ancient faith tradition in the Middle East as well, I represent the largest number of them in the United States in Little Lincoln, Nebraska. And in the summer of 2014, a group of young Yazidi men came to see me. Now, they had earned their citizenship to the United States because they had stood side by side our troops during the height of the Iraq War. They have expertise in translation. And one of the first bills that I worked on in Congress was to allow people who had risked their lives as military translators and then were risking their own families' lives back in where they came from to actually be have special immigration status. And so we got that done, and for whatever reason, an interesting confluence of things, a number of Yazidis decided to make their home in Lincoln, Nebraska. So I've known the community for a number of years, but this particular day, a number of the young men, again, who had literally fought side by side our troops, came to see me. They were on the verge of tears. Many were on the verge of passionate outbreak of anger, and I don't blame them. One of them said to me, "Congressman, you must act. My mother, my sister, they're trapped on Mount Sinjar. They will be killed now. There is no more time." You all remember this, when ISIS swept through the Nineveh plain and troops were pulled out and there was confusion and these people, innocent peoples, were left unguarded. And so there was a resolution previous to the genocide resolution, which we helped recraft, that I'm hopeful it helped contribute to creating a dynamic in which President Obama then ordered airstrikes to save the people on that mountain. But fast forward from there, and we were able unanimously to pass a genocide resolution, because again, the ideal that an entire people could be targeted for extermination is not only a grave violation of the principles of justice, it's a grave violation of the principles of civilization itself. That resolution passed 393-0. We don't pass a Mother's Day resolution in Congress without somebody objecting. What that says is that the gravity of what was happening in the Middle East broke through the collective consciousness of this body here. But it was only a start, as Gus alluded to in reading some of the provisions. Because what has to happen is really three things, particularly in the Nineveh Plain, which hopefully then could be used as a template to maybe even apply in Syria. Resecuritization. People can't return to where they were without it being safe. Second, revitalization. With no hope to be able to flourish, that also doesn't empower people. And then third, those two things create the conditions for repatriation. You have hundreds of thousands of people in refugee camps in Kurdistan, to some degree in Turkey, scattered throughout Lebanon, some in Jordan as well, who are trapped. As the patriarch of the Orthodox Rite, Patriarch John, told me recently, he said, "We don't want to leave." He lives in Syria. He lives on Straight Street. They invited me to come. I said, "Will you lower me in the basket over the wall?" I'm testing your scripture knowledge.
Yes, yeah.
I hope, again, once that was appropriate, Your Excellency. So we had a little laugh about that. But at the same time, their desire to stay is real. And if we don't create these conditions, working with the entire international community and reasoned partners in the Middle East, again, this is going to have severe consequences for migration to Europe, yes, but also the Middle East. So in order to repatriate, we've got to also work on the issues of resecuritization and revitalization. The Vice President made a very important pronouncement about a month ago at an organization called In Defense of Christians, some of which you may have interacted. And he said, "We are going to divert funds directly to the build out, the rebuilding of the conditions from which are preventing Christians and other religious minorities from returning, particularly in the Nineveh Plain, but potentially elsewhere." This is not only a clear statement of policy, it also affirms what we spoke of earlier, that what has happened which has now been affirmed by the United States government, is genocide, and we are going to move resources to create the conditions in which it should never happen or can never happen again. And to me, that was a very important statement by this administration, not only of just a resource move, but also of intention, that this problem, the depth of this injustice, has reached to the highest levels of the United States government and isn't just going to sit there as a policy issue to be checked off the box. It is informing the principles at the highest level of our government that we must act in concert with the international community. Your willingness to gather here today to continue to not only speak about the conditions, but it creates the preconditions politically here in which we are empowered to act, Gus and me and others. Because if everybody just goes away, if we go back comfortably to our own traditions, if we just lament what has happened to our brothers and sisters, then again, the politics of this will tend to take a back seat. So what you're doing today is extremely, extremely important. So I want to thank you. On my way to Cairo last year, where I had some extraordinary meetings with the Coptic community, I also met with the president and the whole slate of political leaders there in the country. But on the way there, I noticed a priest was sitting across the aisle from me. And I asked him, I said, are you a Copt? He said, no, I'm Maronite. And I said, oh, interesting. I said, Father, I want to tell you something. I've been thinking about writing a book, and I want to call it The Last of the Christians. And Bishop Angelos, you know what I'm talking about. All of you here, because of your deep tie to your ancient tradition, know what I'm talking about. But only in a way could a person from the Middle East and the Mediterranean understand. He reacted when I said, I want to write this book, Last of the Christians. He said, it can never be so. With passion. It can never be so. The Holy Spirit is with us, and he will overcome all evil. Thank you all so much.